European campaign came to an end with a 45-7 humbling by Glasgow at the AGFL on Saturday. However, with the Sharks already out of Europe and bigger topics around the game of rugby coming to the fore over the weekend, you'd be hard-pressed to find too many fans who would consider Sale's result the key focus from Saturday. My name is Lewis. Welcome back inside the Shark Tank. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by my co-host, James. James, how are you?
Yeah, all right, mate. I'm just quite glad that there's some other topics of conversation and we don't have to try and talk for 20 minutes about that Glasgow game.
No, absolutely. Anything to get away from squeezing 25, 30 minutes of content around a pretty uninteresting game, to be perfectly honest, is much appreciated. So thank you to Saracens and thank you to Eddie Jones and the rest of the Six Nations squads for giving us something else to talk about. So there's a preview for what's going to come on later on. So obviously, we are a Sale Sharks podcast. At the end of the day, we have to talk about the games at hand for Sale. So let's do a little bit then on the Glasgow game on Saturday. 45-7, as we mentioned, you know, pretty stark defeat for Sale, who were already out of the competition against the Glasgow team, who most certainly weren't and still had the chance to qualify, although ultimately they didn't. James, what was your sort of takeaway from Saturday afternoon?
I don't think it was a case of us just like not turning up at all. I mean, you know, we were pretty fired up at the beginning of the game, but I just think that Glasgow, you know, they're more experienced, more clinical, better. Just in, you know, they just have better players on the pitch. You know, it's full of internationals and the likes of like Nakawara and things, and he's just on a different level to, you know, anybody that we had out on the pitch. I think one of the takeaways I took was, you know, just how much kind of like the spine of the team, that South African spine at least, has an impact. You know, we had Jono out there as our leader. We had, you know, the Currys. You know, Tom is, you know, been in a World Cup final. Ben is, you know, one of the next in line to be captain of the club. And I just felt there was quite a lack of leadership in the team, which sounds, you know, maybe a bit harsh considering the difference in the quality of the two sides. But it did just make me feel that we were really quite reliant on this South African contingent. I mean, what did you feel? Did you feel there was a lack of leadership out there, or would you put your finger on some other issues?
Well, I think as soon as the teams were announced on Friday, that kind of set the tone. The fact that Glasgow, who still had the chance to qualify for the knockout rounds, you know, putting out basically a first-choice team, and Sale obviously not doing that. You know, Currys, Ross, you know, some senior first-team players in there, but obviously going for Curtis at 10, you know, Carpenter at 15, and a very weak bench as well, or very young bench, I probably should say. Sort of set the tone that this was not a game that we were targeting compared to Glasgow. But in terms of leadership, I don't necessarily think it's... That's kind of something I want to throw back to you in a minute and try and get a sense of what you and a lot of Sale fans have actually sort of mentioned over the weekend in terms of that sort of perceived lack of leadership. But I think, based on the teams that were put out there, it kind of goes back to your first point. You know, Glasgow, they're a bit, you know, they're a bigger team physically, they're more experienced, they were better in terms of sort of raw quality. And I think, given where both teams were in the competition, it was kind of an inevitable result that was kind of hinted at, you know, from Friday afternoon when the teams got announced. But let's go back to the leadership aspect then, because, you know, yourself and a few other people I've seen mention this recently. You know, what necessarily is it about Sale's performance on Saturday that kind of worried you from that perspective?
Well, I think you could expect it to be a little bit disjointed, because we brought in a lot of new players and you've got an 18-year-old 10 who hasn't played many games. You're always going to get a bit disjointed. And when you make so many changes week on week, you can get a bit disjointed. The issue is when you throw in the frantic alongside disjointed. And that's what we were to begin with. I think, you know, we came out a little bit pumped up. Jono was definitely in his kind of his red mist mode. And I just feel that, you know, I love the way he brings the fight to the opposition. And, you know, we want to be a difficult team to play against. You know, he's really nuggety, isn't he? He's like Steve Diamond. And there's a lot to love about that. But I just think with the players and the youngsters and the changes that were around him, he needed to bring something a little bit different. He needed to be the cool head, you know, the clarity, calming down. I sort of, for the first 15, 20 minutes, you know, the team was all over the place. We were trying to play a lot of rugby. We were making a lot of errors. And we just couldn't get into the game. And before we knew it, it was beyond us, you know. And like you said, there was inevitability about the results. But I don't think there was an inevitability in terms of clarity of thought and, you know, bringing a cool head and making good decisions and just playing the game that you want to play. And we just didn't execute that at all. And I think that leadership plays a role in that. I was a bit disappointed to see Jono right from the start. He was you know, bringing his difficult character out, and then, you know, obviously getting the simp in, you know, was a real problem. And I think that was a bit of a failure in leadership. And we've seen it once or twice. I mean, look, he makes up for it. You know, this is not, I don't want to be too critical of Jono, because I love him. He was my player of the season last year, and he's still a fantastic guy, fantastic leader in so many other ways. I just think maybe he got that judgment a little bit wrong, and he wanted to lead from the front, didn't he? And actually, when you can't lead from the front when you're sitting on the bench for 10 minutes.
You know, I think that's very fair. And I think with an 18-year-old at fly half, an 18-year-old at fullback, you know, young players with not a lot of first team experience in key positions all around the park. Like you said, you need your players like Jono Ross to step up and be the leaders on the team, because I think it's very pertinent, I think, to note as well that when Ross goes off, it was James Phillips who actually was acting as the de facto captain, which, given that he's obviously in the later stage of his career, but has only been around at Sale for 18 months and it's joined the last season, sort of indicated just how little sort of senior first team experience we had on the pitch at certain points. And it puts extra emphasis on the likes of Ross to lead from the front and stay on the field, as you said, James. And also as well, I think it's unrealistic to expect Tom Curry and Ben Curry, as good as they are, and given that they're actually probably some of our most senior first team players in the match day 23, it's not really fair to expect them to take up the leadership roles along with everything else they're doing as well. So I think I can certainly see why some Sale fans kind of feel that the leadership aspect just wasn't quite there on Saturday, and that kind of turned not necessarily a winning opportunity into a defeat, but maybe accentuated the ultimate margin of defeat that we saw.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, look, it's not the end of the world, is it? Apart from the fact we've now got an away game against Exeter. You know, I can see why we've saved resources for the Premiership, but that sounds a bit difficult. And you'd want to win all your home games, wouldn't you? And now we're going off the back of a couple of losses into the next game. So, you know, if you have a bad day at Exeter, which happens, when I say bad day, I mean, you know, I think getting anything out of the game in Exeter would be a good performance, but you know, getting battered, well, I think would really be a problem for the thing. So it was a big call on selection. I understand, you know, he wants to save his players who are carrying a few injuries. Let's hope we can get them all out on the field against Exeter.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's keep the focus on the game at hand on Saturday then, and go to some three-word reviews. Ben Sweeney, kids gain experience. Alex Etherington, boys versus men. Tom Whittaker, top four key. Sale Sharks fan, disappointing but expected. Jack Worthy, Ferguson curse continues. I quite like that one as a City fan. Simon Holman, viable kids experience. And Richard Lilly, critical players protected. So two key themes there, really. Obviously, one, a sense of rotating the squad, protecting your key players, etc. And the second is obviously about giving, you know, the younger players of the squad some viable experience. And obviously, the two names that stood out the most from Saturday's team sheet was Tom Curtis at 10 and Joe Carpenter at 15. James, how did you think that both Curtis and Carpenter got on Saturday?
I think it was a very difficult situation. I mean, when you sort of, you know, lose the game up front and at the breakdown, and you know you're making mistakes, it's quite difficult, really. And as a 10, you really want a platform. I think, you know, Tom Curtis was a bit lost out there, but you know, he clearly has some excellent skills. And at 18, you know, don't forget he's 2 years behind Kieran Wilkerson and Cam Redpath, and you know, you'd expect him to be quite a talent and a force moving forwards. And I think he'll come on quite quick. In terms of Carpenter, I was actually quite impressed with him. I thought he took a couple of high balls early on, and he can step off both feet and he's quick. And I think that, you know, we weren't really producing a 15 option from the academy ourselves. And, you know, with Hamsley sort of, you know, mid 26, 27. And then the rest were kind of like makeshift options, with Luke James seen more as a centre, I think. And Chris Ashton comes towards the end of his career and more of a winger. So I think that, you know, that looks like he could well be our fullback from about 2 years' time for over 10 years. So I think that he is going to be a very, very good signing and a very good player. Was there anybody else that stood out for you, or do you have some particular thoughts on those two?
Well, starting on Carpenter and Curtis, Carpenter I thought was fine. You know, I think it's really important to remember that not only are both players in their age 18 season, so like you said, probably at least a year, if not 2 years, younger than the average player would be expected to make their Premiership or senior debut. These were players also playing against a very good Glasgow side, a Glasgow side that I think ultimately finished ninth in the overall pool rankings. You know, they could have been a quarter-finalist in the top tier of European rugby. So it's very hard to evaluate their individual performances, given that they are up against a very, very good team. That would make a lot of more experienced players look silly by comparison. Carpenter, like I said, I think he was fine. You know, looks good under the high ball. Positionally, I thought he looked okay. You know, he looks like he's got some decent feet on him. And obviously, he had a great, ultimately he didn't, but it was a try-saving tackle on, I think it was Matawalu late in the second half. You know, we showed really good foot speed. And that's actually something we've lacked at the fullback position for a couple of years now. Even Mike Haley, who was quick, didn't necessarily have that rapid sort of turn of pace that it looks like Carpenter has, albeit on a very limited show. So I thought he looked okay. You know, only played 45 minutes to start with before he was subbed off for Redpath, and obviously he got a few more minutes at the end as well. Curtis, the kind of, again, it's very hard to evaluate him based on the opposition. I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head when you said he looked a little bit lost. You can see that he's probably at least a year or two away from that sort of physical maturity in terms of what you'd want from a 10 standing in your defensive line. Obviously, he took a pretty nasty knock in the second half as well, you know, which is kind of down to, you know, slightly over-energetic technique in defence. And I think it was always going to be, you know, a very tall task for him. But I think when we did get the ball to him in the 10 channel, I think he was a little bit frantic with the ball. He was a little bit sort of jittery in terms of getting the passes off. I think what we saw is he was kind of rushing passes to the players outside him, which meant that a lot of the time when the ball did get out into the midfield to Williams or to Luke James, they weren't necessarily taking it in stride whilst they were at an angle, or even, you know, in terms of catching the ball in front of them and running onto it. There's a lot of times where the passes from Curtis were a little bit rushed. They were kind of going a little bit high. Williams is having to stretch up to his shoulders to catch it. And that has a knock-on effect in terms of your carry and in terms of the collision that you're going to make with the defensive line. So I didn't necessarily see anything that's particularly stood out with Curtis on Saturday. That being said, he's 18. You know, he only just turned 18 against a very good Glasgow side. So it's kind of, it'd be unfair to expect much more out of him. But obviously, I think out of the two, Carpenter was the one who stood out for me, albeit in a position that probably demanded slightly less of him than what Tom Curtis had to face. In terms of other players, to be perfectly honest, there really isn't much to shout about. I thought Matt Postlethwaite looks good again, playing full 80 minutes, leading the line out. He's someone who's going to be very important in the second half of the season. I thought he's done himself no harm with two very good performances in back-to-back weeks. And then I think Marlon Yard, you know, we it's kind of an ongoing project at the moment, just looking at how he's getting on as he rehabs from a very serious injury. You know, he looked fired up, looked energetic. You know, showed his quick feet on a couple of occasions, made some good carries. Defensively, obviously, this quality of the opposition meant that it was always going to be difficult for him to make an impact in that position. And a lot of times he was having to chase wingers and sort of guard two or three players. But I thought, you know, again, as we sort of monitor how he's coming back to become a key contributor for the squad, I thought he had an okay game, even if, again, it was kind of a slightly middle-of-the-road performance and there wasn't really anything to wow you. But I think that was also the case for pretty much the entire Sale squad on Saturday. Was there anyone that caught your eye?
No, I agree with everything you said. I think it was just a difficult day out, first standout performances. But I would agree with you on Matt Postlethwaite. You know, I think that if there's one person that's advanced himself this year in a reasonable way, it is him. Because I think he's proven himself that he can cope at this level. And don't forget, Champions Cup is that level above. And therefore, you know, he's adding depth to our squad. And that's another homegrown academy guy who you would say is now, you know, entering into the Premiership standard of player. So that's really great. And I'm sure he'll continue to learn from all the other guys. And the fact that he looks like the fourth Dupria as well is pretty funny.
Yeah, I saw there's a tweet today that said that had five Duprias listed, and it also included Chris Ashton and Ross Harrison. I think it was amazing that they didn't put Postlethwaite in there, because the amount of times I've actually misseen Postlethwaite as being either Jean-Luc or Dan is actually quite alarming, given that we do a Sale Sharks podcast every week. One player I did want to mention, though, kind of the only other sort of standout for me was Sam Dugdale. When he came on, you know, again, very limited minutes coming off the bench, you know, a very different game context to what a lot of the starting players will have faced. But I thought he looked pretty handy when he came on. I kind of wanted to ask you as well, because you're kind of our prospects guy. Do you see him at the top level as a second row, or is he sort of firmly in a back row camp? And the only reason why he had the 19 jersey on Saturday was because we're a bit short on numbers on the bench.
Yeah, he's a back row, out and out back row. Plays 6, 7, or 8. I think his best position is probably 8, but whether he's quite going to make it at the top level at that position, I'm not sure. I think the jury's out on Sam Dugdale. I think he sort of, you know, coming through, sort of second fiddle a bit, Sam Moore, a bit younger, obviously, but, you know, not quite at the level he was at age group. But what he is doing, Sam Dugdale, is really grounding himself, playing adult rugby. You know, he's been out on loan this season. He's been at Fylde the season before and was one of the best players for the season for them. And he scores tries close to the line, which is good. He's reasonably dynamic. I think he might turn out to be a bit more of a Postlethwaite. Just take that little bit longer than we hoped for. But, you know, these days, to be physical forwards, you don't see many young people just bursting onto the scene from nowhere. You know, the likes of Tom Curry and Alex Donbrandt, who is having a bit of a struggle at the moment, not in the England squad, seems to not be in good books with Gustard either. You know, there aren't many just young back rowers, especially 6 and 8, who just come from absolutely nowhere. The Ted Hills, you know, they're kind of like one in a million. So I think, you know, he's worth persevering with. But yeah, in answer to your question, he's a back row. He's a 6 or 8 who could do a job at 7.
Yeah, very interesting prospects, because, you know, he's at age 20, so kind of the time where you start to see him push forward. And like you said, there's a lot of, you know, very few players are like Tom Curry and burst onto the scene at 18, 19. But I thought actually it was the same in the La Rochelle game. He was one player who kind of coming off the bench kind of made an immediate impact and kind of looked a little bit more physically ready for even, you know, first team rugby and obviously Champions Cup rugby. I think he had a couple of good turnovers, you know, towards the end of that game against Glasgow and looked up for it as well. And that's kind of, I think, in a pretty weak bench from a sell perspective, he was one player who came on and I think made a pretty good impact. Was there anything else from Sale Glasgow that you want to talk about, or are we committed to banishing this to memory?
I think we banish it now rather than pull it apart. What do you reckon?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely fine. I don't really want to talk about getting beat by 38 points at home much more. Let's roundtable really quick, though, on the Champions Cup. Obviously, it's come to an end. Sale have finished bottom of their pool again, as it was the case for the last couple of times we've been in this competition. But obviously, it's had a very different feel to it this year. And Sale, if nothing else, have been very competitive in all their games, even, until round 6, I should say. So on the whole, you know, would you constitute this European campaign as being a success for Sale? Or do you think actually, given our strength in depth and given the group that we had, maybe we could have pushed on a little bit more and you know, at least finished a little bit higher in our pool?
I think he put it down to being useful, but not successful. Useful in the sense that, you know, we've given some exposure to some other guys and we've been far more competitive than we have been in previous years. You know, we have got very, very close to picking up, you know, 2 or 3 wins and finishing third or even second in our group, which was possible until recently. So I think just apart from this last game, which was a bit of the eye-opener to the past, I think it's been useful. But we said that coming third in the group would have been successful. And in that case, that's why I think it's useful but not successful.
I think that seems a very fair summary. Right, well, that's the European campaign wrapped up with a bow on it. And obviously, we've kind of touched upon Alex Donbrandt and Tom Curry and some of the other players who were pushing for England inclusion at both Champions Cup and Challenge Cup level. So let's go on to the Six Nations squads more generally then before we get to the really big news that everyone kind of wants to talk about. So obviously England were the last team to announce their Six Nations squad this morning. There's a single representative from Sale in Tom Curry, picked as part of the team from Eddie Jones and his coaching staff. No Mal Wilson, obviously, is the other key item from a Sale perspective. And Ben Curry, either as a scrum half or a back row, also misses out in terms of inclusion. James, obviously, we're a Sale podcast. We kind of want to keep it Sale focused, but there's obviously a lot of talking points from the England squad. Is there anyone that you in particular want to highlight as being a surprise inclusion or a deserved inclusion?
Well, it's interesting to see Alex Mitchell in there as an apprentice. I think, you know, he's gone with experience at scrum half, but I think Alex Mitchell is kind of a nod to sort of say he's expected to really be the first choice by the time of the next World Cup, which I think is quite an interesting one. Josh Hodges is an apprentice. I've spoken about him before on the podcast. He's going to be a very, very good player, potentially as a full-back by the time of the next World Cup. Obviously, he needs to be playing Premiership Rugby with Newcastle sooner rather than later. I was very disappointed from a Sale point of view. Less so about Ben Curry, who I don't think has done quite enough this year to get ahead of Lewis Ludlam in the pecking order. But for Sam James, I think with Henry Slade injured, I think Sam James was next in line, and his form in the last few weeks has been absolutely extraordinary. He kicks the touch off his left foot. You know, he's done everything he can, and it makes me think that he's just not, you know, he's not in Eddie Jones's mind. He's moving on to the next generation already. Then, you know, Sam James might feel that he's missed his time, but we don't know how long Eddie Jones is going to be around, and he'll have another final opportunity before this World Cup. I hope he isn't overlooked, because he should have been considered. And then the other flag as well is who's going to play number eight, because there's no Donbrandt, there's no Nathan Hughes, I don't think, in the squad. I don't think there's Ben Morgan in the squad. So Ben Earl is in the squad. I don't see him. I still don't know Sam Simmons either, is there? So I think, you know, really, you're looking at Ben Earl playing at eight as the only real person who's played a reasonable amount of rugby at eight. I would say he's more effective at six or seven because I don't think he's got the carrying size at international level for eight. But, you know, in Eddie Jones, we trust. What about you? What stood out for you?
I think for me, the fact, you know, quite a substantial number of uncapped players, this kind of feels like the Six Nations squad after a Rugby World Cup, and it does feel like we are seeing a transition into the next generation of England players with a focus on 2023. I think there's a couple of interesting names. I mean, Ben Earl is you know, a slam dunk inclusion. He's been one of the best players in the Premiership this year, so I completely understand why he's in. But then you kind of look around, you know, and I don't want to disparage Jones and you know, all, you know, the players who've got in on certainly on merit and form, but there is a kind of a feel of flavour of the month to some of these inclusions. Personally, I think the inclusion of Alex Moon and Will Stewart, I'm not necessarily sold on their capacity for test level rugby quite yet. Ted Hill, obviously, who's included again, he's got a single England cap so far. I guess he's probably someone else who could play number eight, but again, I don't think he typically packs down there for Worcester. I think he's more of a six. You know, so a couple of interesting selections, especially in the forwards pack. And then in the back line, I think you've hit the nail on the head from a Sale perspective. The real omission here isn't Curry, and it isn't really Wilson, who's obviously kind of aging out of this next World Cup cycle. It is Sam James, because I think he, as well as Tom Curry, have been our best English qualified players this year. And the inclusion of Fraser Dingwell, who comes in at 2021, kind of suggests exactly what you mentioned, James, that Jones is already looking to the next generation. And actually, Sam James at 25, I believe he is probably actually aging out ever so slightly. That's not to say he doesn't get a chance, you know, later on, but it does kind of feel that maybe the ship has sailed for Sam James. And it does kind of always makes me wonder why the England Saxons team isn't still going, because obviously that would be another opportunity to get sort of semi-test level rugby experience for a lot of these players. And And it does make me wonder, you know, you see Mike Haley, who had a great series in South Africa in 2016, go to Ireland to play. You know, you do wonder whether or not England are missing out on some of these players by not having a competitive B team to actually test these players at a slightly higher level than the Premiership. The other one as well for me was Jacob Umaga, who's obviously been included not as an apprentice player, but actually as a full member of the squad. Again, very, very exciting prospect, but how much game time he actually gets, you know, with Farrell and Ford in the squad, I don't really know. And again, it kind of feels like there's a little bit of a flavour of the month feel there in that he's playing pretty well at the moment, so he does get a shot in there. The England squad as well. So I think a pretty competitive team. There's obviously a transition towards the next World Cup, which I think is absolutely the right thing. And there's some really exciting talents in there. You know, Ollie Thorley, George Furbank, you know, looking into the pack, you've got the likes of Lewis Ludlam, who had a great World Cup. You know, he's deserving of more time. And obviously Luke Cowan-Dickie will probably get another shot as well with some extended time at hooker. But I do kind of feel that it's kind of a mixed bag. And from a sale perspective, it's probably actually as we'd expect, sans Sam James. In terms of the other Six Nations squads, though, obviously Sale are actually represented in both the Scottish and the Welsh squad, so it would be remiss of us not to feature them as well. Byron McGuigan has been called back up into the Scotland squad after missing out at the 2019 World Cup. And obviously, the bigger news from last week that we didn't get a chance to mention on last week's podcast is that Will Griff John has been included in Wayne Pivock's first Welsh international squad. And he's one of five uncapped players that's been selected. James, you know, Byron McGuigan, obviously someone who's been around the Scotland squad for a while. It's kind of to be as expected. But Will Griff John, obviously, absolutely fantastic news for both the player and the club. And, you know, what did you make of their respective inclusions in their respective Six Nations squads?
Actually, a bit surprised at McGuigan, not on form, because, you know, he's been our best winger this year. And I do think it was a mistake of Scotland not to take him to the World Cup. I think he's the type of guy you want around, away from home, you know, for a long time. And it brings the kind of fight and commitment on the pitch that you kind of need, whether you're playing in the big games or in the lesser group games. So that was a mistake. So, you know, look, he's not going to make the next World Cup. So I am a bit surprised about that. Will Griff John, I mean, you know, he's absolute slam dunk for me to get into the Wales squad. You know, they don't have a lot of depth. Samson Lee's gone backwards, you know, and they do need to bring through some more options at tight head, especially with Thomas Francis injured. So, you know, Will Griff John, he's Welsh qualified. Obviously, he came through the system at Cardiff before he went off. But, you know, I think he's really solid scrummager. But where he really earns his corn is around the park. You know, his defensive ability, Alex's stats that he takes us through, you know, he's often right up there as a tackler. You know, he's a real modern day prop. You know, he now needs to be tested at the test match level on his fitness, whether he can get through to 60, 65 minutes and remain competitive and keep his work rate up at that level. And then also the scrummaging, because you're going to come across more consistent, stronger scrummagers across the board. So that'll be really interesting. But I wish him all the best. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens around contract. We know through the Thomas Francis example that there's no reason why, you know, he can't stay at Sale and keep extending his contract. But, you know, there might be some money coming in for him that we can't compete with. So good luck to him. I'll watch with interest.
Absolutely. And the contract situation is obviously the interesting dynamic to John's inclusion in the squad, because obviously you'd imagine, you know, the Welsh Rugby Union could potentially have identified John as someone that they would be keen to lure back to play for a Welsh region. And obviously giving him a cap now and giving him some extended time in and around the squad might make that decision to offer him a contract as part of a deal to play for the national squad. You know, that could be obviously be an incentive for the Welsh Union to cap him now. So, you know, very interesting. I think he's obviously a player who's shown that he's not only excelling at a Premiership level, but obviously he could excel at an international level. Whether or not he becomes a 60-70 cap guy, I don't know. But obviously it is always good to see not only English talent being selected in international squads, but obviously the fact that other countries are paying attention to the players who are playing the trade at the AJ Bell as well. So great news for Byron, great news for Will Griff John, and obviously great news for Tom Curry as well. We can't really talk about the Six Nations squad now and not discuss, you know, the six or seven players who've been picked, who'll be playing in the Championship next season. And that obviously brings us quite neatly to Saracens as a general topic. James, obviously, you're someone, you live quite close to Saracens. You know, you're someone who's actually quite, you know, involved in the club and the sort of local community around the club. Obviously, this is probably the biggest story in English club rugby history, and I don't think it's overstating it to say that. So, obviously, as someone who kind of obviously knows a lot about how the club operates and you know, is very sort of close to that community of fans, you know, what was your immediate reaction to the news that Saracens will be automatically relegated from the Premiership next season for failing to prove compliance with this year's salary cap?
Yeah, I mean, we probably got to the right end point, didn't we, in the end? But it's been too painful. I mean, Saracens have been punished in an enormous way for cheating. You know, quite rightly, if you cheat, you've got to get punished in any form of life. I feel very strongly about that. But let's not underestimate the size of the punishment, and I include the initial punishment in this. You know, the fine would have sent most clubs under, and actually it still might. It still might be the end of Saracens. We don't know how it's all going to play out as things sort of, you know, the squad dismantles, etc. But 5.8 million or whatever it was is an extraordinary sum. And, you know, let's not forget that the beneficiaries of this are the rival clubs. It's not like going into the wider game, of course, is it? And I think that, you know, everyone getting 500 grand or whatever just leaves a bit of a bitter flavour in the mouth, which leads me onto a wider point not being discussed enough, which is Premiership Rugby's role in this, which I think has been unsatisfactory at every point. You know, if they hadn't nodded and winked at the last breach, I don't think we would have been here now. You know, you allow certain behaviour to go on and you can't be surprised that it continues. The message that they sent out at that time was that the cap would not be strongly regulated. So, you know, if the organisation and judgments were transparent, we also wouldn't be second guessing. So in my mind, Premiership Rugby have brought the game into disrepute every bit as much as Saracens have. But, you know, Saracens have cheated. They've been robustly punished. And they should have done from the start. Years ago, when, you know, was it 2015 or whatever it was, when things, or 2014, when the first thing came out, behind the closed doors deal and all sorts, very unsavoury. And so, you know, Premiership Rugby cannot be surprised that this is where we've ended up. And clearly asking them to balance the books by the end of January was just never going to be possible mid-season. Saracens should have handled the situation so much better as well. I think it's such a shame that they just, that, you know, they. I know it was disputed around, especially around payment and investments, but as soon as they decided that they weren't going to appeal the first time, there should have been so much more contrition. I'm somebody that doesn't think that, you know, Griffiths was the right decision as CEO. I think he's still a little bit tarnished from the start of the Saracens journey and doesn't have the right amount of public empathy to have carried it. And I think that was a massive mistake. But I do think that surely a more sensible and logical outcome of this should have been, number one, audit of books at the end of the year. Yeah, without fail. And that should have been the first punishment. That at the end of this season, there'll be another full audit, right? So they have to have balanced the books by that stage. Mid-year, I mean, that's just silly. And secondly, you know, because I doubt that they would have been able to, even by the end of the year, finish under, then you get another 35-point deduction for the next season. That would have meant 2 years without being in the Champions Cup rugby, still would have seen somewhere quite a large amount of player turnover and would have had to have led to transparency, which is the thing that's undermining the game. So as it stands now, you've got families that are uprooted, you've got stress and anxiety that's been caused, livelihoods under threat. I do think that that was avoidable if both Saracens had showed more contrition and Premiership Rugby had handled it a little bit better. You know, there are regulations and then there is self-interested revenge, and I think that the problem with this is it's kind of a borderline of both of those. I think it's a shame because the foundation, the free school, the player academy, the coaching, the stadium, the investment in the local community is a model that is far beyond, I think, the selfish and rugby-centred aims of most of the clubs, and I do think it's unrivaled. Saracens ultimately shoulder the majority of the blame and have been rightly punished, but one thing that I'll leave you with is that, for me, Premiership Rugby is murky and not fit for purpose. And that is why, even now, with the ultimate punishment of relegation and the possible breakup of a club, that the whole affair still feels unresolved and unsatisfactory.
Yeah, I think, first, obviously, I wholeheartedly agree with all those points. And I think it's important to state that from the outset. I think for me, the Saracens saga, as it is, is a symptom of a larger problem with modern rugby and how Premiership rugby operates. I've been banging this drum for as long as I can remember now. But the fact that the competitiveness of this league is predicated on a salary cap system, and yet we have a league where salaries and team spending is not transparent, is completely unthinkable. And whilst I think Saracens have been duly and justly punished and absolutely unequivocally deserve to be in the Championship next season and potentially should have their titles stripped, such as how strongly I feel about it, I think we can't ignore the fact, as you put, James, that this has been allowed to happen by the negligence or the self-interest of Premiership rugby. The fact that Saracens were being investigated 4 or 5 years ago, along with Bath and a couple of other teams, and that nothing came out of it, you know, behind closed doors deals, handshake agreements, NDAs with the other stakeholders in the competition. You know, it speaks to the fact that this was a completely preventable incident and, scandal. And the fact is, Premiership Rugby didn't do anything to dissuade teams like Saracens from cheating. And whilst I think it's really important that we put the right amount of blame on Saracens for cheating, and they do deserve to have, their Premiership status, taken away, and obviously, maybe their titles. We'll come on to that in a second. I think it is really important that we go back to the reason why this was allowed to happen. And the fact is, Saracens and, potentially other teams were able to get around the salary cap rules on which this league is based because we don't have clear and transparent information regarding how much money teams are spending, how much money is going on player salaries, and actually how the entire salary cap system works. And I think actually this, if nothing else, this is the strongest indicator yet that we need serious reform of the Premiership salary cap system and actually open the league up and the teams up a little bit more to make sure that incidents like this don't happen again in the future. James?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Saracens got their punishment now. I think it's very serious punishment. As I said, we shouldn't underestimate it. And they now have to do what they need to do to manage the situation. It's going to be massive. Now, let's turn the attentions almost away from Saracens while they sort their shit out. Yeah, the players and the staff and all the rest of it have got enough stress without the media continuing to breathe down their neck. And instead, we need to turn the fire onto Premiership Rugby. And that includes the role of the rival clubs as well, which I think has been, questionable and not, as I said, fit for purpose. It's just not a good organisation. And the salary cap doesn't work. There is no doubt that, Saracens have not been supported enough for producing so many good England players. Now, yes, I heard Lawrence Dalio's argument. Well, you get to the stage where they cost too much money and then they can move to rival clubs and then you sort of spread it. But this kind of like spreading of cost and of income, I think it's good in some ways and not good in others. And I think that you still need to find a way to encourage clubs to grow their own, yeah, rather than just manage them on how much money they're spending on salaries. Because at the end of the day, we want to be, yes, producing a good product, but I think we can do that anyway. But, we want to be producing players for England and local people who are playing for their local clubs. And I think that it's, again, as I say, unsatisfactory when a club like Saracens can't keep all of their academy players in their squad. Now, what I think you should be crucifying them on is, why are you spending so much money on Will Skelton when you've got the second rows that you have in the club? Well, the truth is, Will Skelton's available all year round and we still need to win the Premiership. So when we're without three of our second rows with England, we're a bit stuffed. So it's a real issue. And I think that Saracens, what you need to isolate is Saracens have cheated. They've been severely punished. Right, close off. What are the things that have driven Saracens to this behaviour? Yeah. partly the desire to win, but then all these other issues that don't just disappear. And Premiership rugby needs to be reformed so that this sort of thing never happens again. And a salary cap, and as you said, is root and branch rethinking right from the start. But I don't see anything from Premiership rugby. No proactivity. They just want, from a comms perspective, they're quite happy for all the noise to be around Saracens. How much did Mark McCall know? How much did Alex Anderson know? You know, surely Owen Barrell or Brad Barrett as captain kind of, surely the players knew. In the, no. We need to be, why aren't we hearing from Premiership rugby? We hear nothing from them. It's completely unsatisfactory. And it really does not bode well, because as the game is becoming more and more professional and there's more and more money in the game and there's more agents involved and all the rest of it, if we don't sort out the governance of the game now, yeah, it's gonna get completely out of control. And frankly, it's going to become a game that, you know, we don't feel proud of. And that's the problem with, you know, we've always had, well, we're better than football. Yeah, we only get a third of the people coming to watch, but, you know, we're a better sport. Well, you know, questionable.
I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because I think there's a larger discussion to be had about the salary cap limits and academy credits. But one, you've actually sort of neatly led me on to one of my other points about salary cap transparency, is actually, we talk a lot about how do you grow the game and how you need stewardship and leadership at the top to help, you know, increase rugby's, you know, share of the sports market in the UK. And I do wonder whether or not salary cap transparency. I know a lot of people don't really like the idea of players' salaries being public as well. But I know we've spoken off the air about one of the issues that Premiership rugby and rugby in general has is that there's a lack of 24/7 content around the sport. There's a lot of, I'll show up on the Saturday, I'll watch the team play, and then I will go about my business for the rest of the weekend and completely forget about the sport until next weekend. And actually, from a punditry perspective, from people like ourselves who are effectively content creators, talking about the game, drumming up interest, encouraging people to go out and watch it, there's actually a really good argument to be made about how actually opening up the salary cap, opening up player finances, opening up how teams operate and are spending the money and how they're allocating that money to their playing squad, that would actually lead to a massive boon in off-the-field interest for Premiership rugby as well, because all of a sudden, your praise or your criticism or your analysis of the game gets an entirely new dimension when you're able to factor in the fact that player X is performing better than player Y, but player X makes half the amount of money. And I think the other key aspect of it as well is that it also means that your entire competitiveness of the league and how it's built gets viewed in a refreshing new light. Because we all know Saracens could spend the cap and Sale couldn't in previous years. But we didn't know how big the difference was. We didn't know whether or not Saracens were spending twice, three times, four times as much as Sale. And that actually means that you know, players, teams, clubs, everyone gets a completely wrong perspective on how the league operates. And actually opening up to how player and club finances work would actually make for, I think, a much more honest and level-headed approach to club fandom from a Premiership Rugby perspective. And actually, I think that would almost certainly help raise both the profile of the sport and the amount of off-the-field interest and really help to grow the game. Now, I know that's quite an aggressive view about salary cap transparency, and I know a lot of people aren't going to agree with me. But I know from someone who, you know, from two people and obviously Alex as well, who do have to do a podcast every single week, it would make a massive difference if we know exactly why teams like Saracens and Exeter were better than us. Is it because they're getting more for the money, or is it because they just have more money? What do you think of that, James?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I wouldn't support full transparency on individual player pay, but I do think that there are some summary KPIs and reports that are required and that all companies should publish. And that could be around, you know, it needs to be around revenue, you know, what that's being spent on off field and on field. You know, you might be able to do a quartile thing, how many players are in the top quartile of earners from across the Premiership, so you can see the makeup of the squad. You know, some people might go for more people in the middle and you know, and less people at the extremes. Other squads might be a bit smaller. You know, percentage of homegrown talent, things like this. Just some core summary KPIs. reports that we could do a comparison on, which I think would be important. From Saracen's point of view, I mean, by the time they come back up into the Premiership, let's say that the club do manage to keep it together and do come up automatically next season, the season after next, then, you know, they have to be transparent at that point. I mean, not on individual player pay, but they're going to have to prove that they are under the cap. And actually, you know, I'm pretty certain that by the time they do that, other clubs won't have already proactively done it. Yeah. And then the pressure will suddenly turn on to clubs to do it. So I think they can earn the trust back by doing it in the right way. I can understand why they didn't, they didn't want to be audited by, clearly because they're bloody miles over the cap. And, you know, as soon as you include their player investments and, you know, they had to be balanced by the end of the month, which is completely ridiculous. So, you know, they what they've decided is, well, we're going to be relegated anyway because we'll be given another 35-point fine this season. So it may as well decide we're relegated now and at least people can plan and all the rest of it and we can make plans for being in the Championship. But, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that they need to come back and be transparent as a club. But Premier Rugby need to change the way things are done. And, you know, I think that the way it's run by the CEOs and it's just all fucking weird, basically. And I think they need to sort it out quickly because that's why they're bringing the game into as much disrepute as Saracens. And I really do honestly believe that.
Absolutely. It does not feel like there is a genuine strategy from the hires up at Premiership Rugby to help grow the game and actually make sure that a similar saga, which is going to leave a black stain on the game for God knows how long, that there does not appear to be a strategy that looks, you know, to avoid a similar incident happening. And I, you know, a small step would make a lot of sense.
It's not even sensible from a commercial point of view because they're really damaging the brand. Right, you know, you're not made. You know, it's meant to be a family sport and all the rest of it. So, putting that to one side, they don't even seem to have a love and care for the base level of the game. You know, Saracens has just been fined 5.8 million. What a great opportunity to invest in the game in a real strategic and inclusive way. And instead, all the clubs just get 500k. There we go, just to fund the overspending that already happens and the loss making across the organisation. So it's not sensible commercially and it's showing no attachment to and no commitment to the sustainability of the game. And then, you know, then you read that, you know, the Lions tour is only going to be 8 games and they're not even willing to move the Premiership final by 1 week, which is finishing. This isn't even the year after World Cup year. It's the year after that and we're still finishing the season in June. It's just, I'm sorry, but there are some real fundamentals here. And I know we set this in store, you know, when the RFU, you know, and the whole Premier Rugby was set up. But, you know, I do think there are some real fundamental worrying things about the way Premiership Rugby is working and really, you know, it's sort of completely counterproductive to what I think its aims are.
Yeah, it's hard not to be sceptical of the direction that Premiership Rugby is going in, especially in light of this saga and everything that's happened before and everything that's actually happened since. And like you said before, that lack of communication and leadership from the powers that be. Two more questions just on Saracens to wrap things up. The first, do you think they should have their titles stripped?
No, because you can't play out what would have happened. You know, I think if he takes titles off someone, then they have to go to somebody else. So I think that's probably a step in the other direction. Also, I think that ultimately the people you punish there are the players. And I think that the players have performed to the best of their ability. So I think overall, no. But my main reason for no is, can we just draw a line and move the hell on?
Okay, that's fair enough. And the second question, obviously, a lot of focus now for the rest of the season is going to be on Saracen's squad and moving players out to make sure they're cap compliant and obviously the sort of moves that are going to have to be done between both now and the end of the season and obviously moving forward. So a lot of talk already about some of the names that might ship out. I think a lot of what's been suggested in terms of losing some of these international stars might be a little bit overstated. There is a good chance that the likes of Farrell, Otoji, Ezekwe, Jamie George, you know, the sort of homegrown England internationals, you know, there's a good chance they could stay given that there is no salary cap in the Championship, I believe, or if it is, it's the same as the Premiership rugby's. There's also a bigger conversation there as well about you have to be cap compliant for two years prior to going back up. So I'm not sure how that's going to work with, from a Saracens perspective. But I think it's very clear that from Saracens' view, they will look to keep their English homegrown internationals as a priority, and they actually can, in theory, operate in the Championship and potentially come back up to the Premiership by retaining those players. But that does leave a lot of players potentially on the outside looking in. So, James, to bring this back to Sale after 35 minutes or whatever, who that is likely to leave Saracens, do you think Sale would be wise to target as a potential signing?
Well, I think the problem is that we're spending up to the cap and there's not going to be much turnover of players. So, you know, we kind of invested in the squad in the wrong year in hindsight. Bryn Evans is probably going to retire. So second row, I think Nick Ezekwe would be, you know, absolutely fantastic. 21 years of age, calling the line out, really mobile around the park, would be a very, very clever signing. But as we're bringing in someone more experienced like George Cruz, but it sounds like he's off to Japan. So other than that, I just don't see how we're going to fit them into the squad and under the salary cap. So I don't see being able to target really anyone, unfortunately, unless there's injury dispensation and we bring somebody in on loan. And I do think that we'll see, you know, I agree with you that there'll be more players stay than you think, because even people do joke about the culture at Saracens, but you know they really do look after the players there, and I think that some of them will want to give back, especially the homegrown guys. And what you might find is a deal maybe with a Super Rugby side where the Saracens players are going to be with England for part of the summer. And then, of course, during the November internationals, where they're in camp for a huge amount of time, so Eddie Jones is going to have a lot of control over them. And, you know, basically win enough points in the Championship to put Saracens so far out. Then you're into Six Nations. And then I imagine they might go out on loan maybe to a Super Rugby side. So they're still getting high-level rugby for the majority of the season, but also ensuring that Saracens know. I wouldn't be surprised to see something like that. And then, you know, using sort of the dispensation that Eddie Jones has, it is, you know, for special situations, which, you know, basically your main rider of talent going under, getting relegated, is a special situation. So you might see some go to Super Rugby halfway through the season and some others going to Japan or France for more money. But we just don't know. We just have to see how it plays out. I mean, who have you got your eye on? I mean, there's two questions in there. Who have you got your eye on? Who would you like? And then, are we actually going to be able to afford any of these players?
I think, yeah, any conversation about Sale getting any players from Saracens has to begin and probably end with the salary cap. We are a cap, as we understand it, we are a cap team this year. There's probably not a lot of wiggle room, even if we're not. And so I think that severely limits our options unless we do see a high earner leave the squad. Now, actually, looking at Sale's squad, we've got most of our high earners locked in, you know, on long-term deals, which is good. But obviously, it does mean that we don't really have any flexibility. Unless, for example, Marlon Yard, I think he's the most likely candidate to leave, and that might free up a little bit of cap room. Obviously, you know, Itoje, Cruz, Ezekwe, you know, these are tier one international players at a position of need for Sale, because obviously that's kind of where we are looking a little bit light on the ground. And in terms of, immediate upgrades, I think those would obviously represent, you know, the absolute best. You know, going from James Phillips and Bryn Evans, no disrespect to those two players, to Itoje or Cruz or whoever, would obviously, you know, be a massive boon to the squad. But actually, as this news came out, I did have a look down the Saracens shopping list, and there's a couple of really interesting players that I have had my eye on for a couple of years now. Jack Singleton, the hooker who joined from Worcester at the beginning of this season, you know, very highly touted, somebody who's already been in and around the England squad, and also somebody who's not been at Saracens for a long time and actually might find themselves on the outside looking in if it does, you know, push comes to shove and they have to start to prioritise their England players that they want to keep and give priority to Farrell and Jamie George, etc. So I think he's someone who actually both represents someone who might leave Saracens in search of more opportunities, and somebody who would actually make a difference in the sales squad, given that he could probably slot in alongside Aka van der Merwe, with Rob Barberoni having a year left on his current deal. Couple of other players, Max Malins, very exciting prospect. He's broken into the Sarri's first team this year. He's a he can play 10, he can play 15. He was linked with Exeter early in the season, so I imagine that might that's a move that might be rekindled now. But in terms of looking at our options in those positions, I think he'd be an absolutely fantastic prospect to get in, and again, someone who might come in a little bit cheaper, which obviously is important when you're a team like Sale near the salary cap. And then the other player, I mean, Nick Tompkins is obviously somebody I'd love to add in the centres. I think that's the other area as well as Locke, where we're a little bit lightweight. And actually, Tompkins would make would be a brilliant player to have rotating in with Sam James in the 13 outside Van Rensburg. But obviously, with him just being capped by Wales in the Six Nations squad, it's likely that the WRU might make a play for him this year. So again, not necessarily one where that's all too feasible. And then Alex Lazowski, another guy, he's English, he's kind of come through the Saracens Academy. Probably not a player that they won't be wanting to get rid of. But again, if we're looking at sort of fly half and centre as being our sort of positions of need after Locke, that's another player where potentially someone like Marlon Yard leaving might free up the cap space that we'd need to get someone like Lazowski. So I think, those are four players that I'd sort of immediately circled as filling a need for Sale and being of the sort of talent that we need to push on in the wake of Saracens leaving and becoming the Premiership and becoming a top four team. And also players who I think, would also wouldn't break the bank. Is there anyone out of those four that you think might be feasible for Sale, James?
Well, I think they would break the bank if we're not moving somebody on. So, Joel Kopoku's another name, isn't he? That it sounds like he might be off to Northampton anyway. But I think that, apart from the second row, we would have to make active decisions. So, Rob Webber leaving a year earlier than planned, because I don't think you just bring Jack Singleton into the current squad. I think someone would have to leave to make room. And he's a young guy, but we've also got other young hookers that are coming through. So I'm not sure that would be the best investment. Obviously, Nick Tompkins is a brilliant player, but even if he's not going over to play for a Welsh side, he's going to be gone in November and during the Six Nations. So I'm not sure that would be necessary. Max Maynard would be brilliant, but would probably require McGinty to leave earlier than planned. So I think where you're looking at all of these options, I think you're absolutely right. You've identified some brilliant players, a lot of which are either, still got all their best years ahead of them or available like Lazowski all year round and can play in multiple positions. But someone's got to leave to create room for them.
Will Griff John to Wales and Vincent Cochin?
Yeah, maybe. I'm a bit wary of the Saffers because, they're kind of, once we get back into the normal routine, they're gone. I mean, it might be Vincent Cott might be now past, but, he's 30, isn't he? So he might not make the next World Cup. So maybe they move on from him, in which case that would be a brilliant signing. Absolutely.
There we go. Well, regardless of what happens with Saracens over the coming months, one team that looks to benefit the most, as well as Sale, will be Exeter, who probably now stand alone at the top of Premiership Rugby's pantheon of great teams. And unfortunately for Sale, that's who we have next as Premiership Rugby action returns after the European break. So obviously, we've already seen Exeter three times already this season to varying degrees of disappointment. But James, is there, as we go back to Exeter for a fourth time this year as part of our preview segment, is there anything new that you can bring to the table in terms of Sale's next game and a juicy preview to come?
Well, what can I say? I mean, they've got home quarter final and potentially semi-final in the Champions Cup. Home semi-final and possibly final in the Premiership Rugby Cup. They're top of the Premiership. I mean, can you imagine anyone stopping them winning that competition this season? I could see them getting a treble. I mean, certainly a double. They're unbeaten in all competitions since oddly losing at home versus Bristol on the 10th of November. We know how they play. It's phase play. It's retention of the ball. It's big carries across the park. They do the simple things well. They make few mistakes. They're well-structured and organised. They build the points, but they're also capable of scoring tries. They're unstoppable 5 metres out, but they can also play. The the likes of Joe Simmons now, first choice at 10. Sam Simmons brings a dynamism in the back row, which we'll need to contain. Don Armand's, you know, been struggling for fitness and lost a bit of form, but they just bring in Jacques Vermeulen, who's just kind of just the like-for-like replacement and brilliant signing for them. Dave Ewers is back in form. Cowan Dickey and Harry Williams might well be starting for England in the Six Nations. Ollie Devoto is taking on more responsibility in the centres with Slade injured, using his kicking game, especially with Sam Hill or Ian Whitten doing the basics and, you know, organising the defence alongside him. And then you've got, you know, Hogg, who replaces Cordero in bringing that X factor to the back line. So, you know, as always with these, when you say, you know, is there anything new about this preview compared to all the other Exeter previews? And not really. I mean, you kind of, you pray to the rugby gods that we can get something, anything from the game. So, I mean, really, it's over to you, Lewis. I mean, how do we get something from the game?
Pray, I think. The problem is, James, as you just said, you know exactly how Exeter are going to play, and you can't plan for it. You know, they are just so good. They are so clinical. They are the undisputed favourites to win the league this year. And I think a Premiership and European double a la Saracens is actually a very, very real prospect now. In terms of how Sale stopped them, well, it will take, you know, a Herculean effort and probably one of our best performances of the season. You're hoping for a star turn from Faf de Klerk, who is likely to be back in contention. Obviously, the talk was that Mark Wilson and Lou Diaga might be able to make their debuts for Sale in this game. Whether or not that's still a possibility, we're not sure. You know, Diaga, I think, came to England slightly later than planned. Mark Wilson has been in training, though, so he's probably more likely to start. So what you really need is a couple of big names like Diaga and Wilson to come back in and really sort of round off that 23. You need star performances from de Klerk and Van Rensburg, certainly possible. And I think the other thing as well is you need a really good performance from your back three, and probably one that we've not quite seen yet, because Exeter, you know, as with every other position, they're absolutely stacked with talent. But playing down at Sandy Park, playing with, you know, really strong wins means that they've all automatically got a tactical edge in terms of positional play, because they're so good at managing the game and kicking the ball and using the wind to their advantage. So what you need from a Sale perspective is you need some real counter-attacking threat. And now would be a great time for Denny Solomona to break out his try-scoring boots. You know, Chris Ashton as well, he's had an okay season, but not necessarily sort of been the impact player that we might have expected. We need these players to really start to put pressure on opposition teams, starting with Exeter, with their counter-attacking game. And it will be interesting to see who we select at 15, because Simon Hammersley's had an okay start to his time at Sale, but he's not really given us that counter-attacking threat that we needed. You know, we actually seen more counter-attacking sort of impetus from Luke James when he played against Harlequins a couple of weeks ago. So who we play at 15 is going to be really important. But I think what we need is brilliant performances from de Klerk and Van Rensburg. We need really good performances from Oosthuizen, Van der Merwe, you know, Webber, etc. We need Tom Curry to play like he's playing for England. We need Ben Curry to play like he's playing for England. We need Mark Wilson and Lou Diaga to make their way into the 23. And we need Simon Hammersley to do something he's not done all season and really show a lot of counter-attacking threat. So if this all sounds a little bit out of the realm of possibility, I think it might be. But the enduring point of this is Exeter are a bloody good team, and Sale will be lucky to get anything out of this game. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's very difficult to imagine Sale getting anything out of this game without a fantastic performance from those key performers that I've just highlighted there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're gonna, as you rightly said, we're gonna have to bring our A game in every area of the field. You know, I think it starts though by doing the basics right. It's a long way from home if you can't catch your own ball in the line out and you're getting pushed off at every scrum. So I think you do your basics right, and you hope that Rob Dupreer has got his kicking boots on. You know, there's no McGinty. We hear his injury is not as bad as feared, and you know he could be back in the spring, which is good news. But you know, it does mean that Rob Dupreer needs to be on with his kicking boots every single game for the rest of the season. So you know, then you just you just never know, do you? I mean, we do something down in Exeter, even if it's just a bonus point loss. We obviously go to Saracens. I think it's the next game is Saracens away, which is obviously bloody tough, but actually less tough than it would have been now with the latest judgment. Fingers crossed we can get something there. But I think we're going to go down and almost see this Exeter game as a cup tie. You know, a lot of our players have had a bit of rest. They do earn picked at the weekend. And if we can physically bring the type of performance that we brought in the last home game, then you never know. So are you going Hammersley at 15 or are you going to Luke James?
I think if Hammersley's fit, you go with the specialist fullback. I think Luke James has looked pretty good the last couple of weeks, but I would certainly go away at Sandy Park with Hammersley at 15. I would then be tempted, as I suggested, to maybe go with Solomona and Ashton on the wings. You don't really have anything to lose. And if you're going with the safe choice at 15 with Hammersley, I'd maybe put Solomona in ahead of McGuigan, just because he offers you a little bit more of an X factor. And then from there, the team does kind of pick itself. You know, De Klerk at 9, Dupreer at 10, Van Rensburg at 12, Kearney Oosthuizen in the front row, probably at 3, maybe, or potentially at 1, actually. So maybe it doesn't pick itself, given how well Will Gratton's played the last couple of weeks. But you've got to have Oosthuizen in there. He's in the front row. He's been a real impact player, no matter which position he's been playing. And then obviously Dan Dupreer at 8, Tom Curry at 7, and then probably John O'Ross at 6. But I think there's also maybe a shout for Jean-Luc Dupreer in at 6. But that being said, if he doesn't get the nod over Jono, I would expect Jean-Luc in at the second row as well, just to give us a bit more ball-carrying and physicality up front. So I don't necessarily know how the positions will shake out, but it's very clear who our best 15 players are at the moment. And I think apart from maybe one or two, which side of the scrum Oosthuizen plays on, for example, you know, Hammersley at 15 or Ashton, for example, I think it's pretty clear that the squad that we'd be looking to put out if we're going to get anything out of this game.
Okay, so what should we do? Some predictions. What do you reckon?
I think that sounds good. I'm going to say even if Mark Wilson and Lou Diaga play, I'm going to say Exeter 30, Sale 20. I think we've obviously got the squad now to compete at places like Sandy Park, but it does still feel like we're maybe a season away from being at a point where we can really make the games competitive. And I think on the current form that the Chiefs are showing, they are a class above everyone else, Sale included. So I'm going to go a comfortable win for Exeter and unfortunately nothing for Sale. 30 points, 20. So what about yourself, James?
I think you're pretty much spot on. So I'll go 32-18.
Brilliant. Well, it's nice to know that we're on the same page for things other than just Saracen salary cap saga. So that's another episode in the books. I want to say a massive thank you to everybody who's been tweeting us over the weekend. Thanks to everyone who engaged with all the stuff around the Glasgow game. Thank you to everyone who's been listening and continuing to follow us on Twitter. You know, we really appreciate it. Thank you for the 3-word reviews. And thank you, James, for joining me and having the sort of inside scoop on what the Saracen saga means for the North London community. I think that's everything from me. Is there anything else from you, James?
No, not at all. Just, you know, fingers crossed we can pick up a point or whatever at Exeter. And I hope that all the guys travelling down have a good day. Exeter's a cracking weekend away.
Brilliant. Well, regardless of the result on Saturday, we'll speak to you guys next week.